You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm well. I'm trying to think. Is that an exaggeration? No, I'm fine with that. I'm well. And let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter, to which everyone should subscribe. And this is the Non-Zero Podcast. And you are Mike Pesca, famous podcaster, longstanding podcaster, a godfather.
I've been doing this for a while.
Are you a godfather of podcasting?
My godchildren have shunned me. I've led the way and others saw my example and learned from it, but didn't follow in my wake necessarily. I don't know. I've been doing it a long time. It sometimes surprises people. It sometimes surprises people who've also been doing it a long time, 11, 12 years. And we say it's the longest daily news and analysis show. So those are important factors in trying to lay claim to the mantle of the longest. It's daily, and it is not a news show like The Daily, which we're longer, but we analyze the news, but we mostly deal with the news.
Uh-huh. And you started on Slate, but are now solo, and your podcast is called The Gist.
Important to get that out. Thank you for that. Yes, it is The Gist. It is found every day. Yes.
I understand your incentive structure. I know you're not here to talk to me. Let's face it. You want to get the brand out.
I want to talk to you. It is my dream to talk. I can't believe I've never talked to you in podcast form.
It is kind of a shame because we've both been in the game a long time. We both have our claims to godfatherhood. So let's see. Before I say more about you, and there is more to say, let me say what we're going to talk about is the future of media. Who better to talk about that than a couple of godfathers of podcasting? We're not going to just talk about podcasting, but the whole landscape, including newsletters and old media and so on. And we're going to say a little bit about the future of sports, as long as we're talking about things that we both enjoy talking about. And then here's the crazy part. Once we go into overtime, you know, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, we're going to talk about Israel. And I'll leave it for people to figure out how that fits alongside sports and media naturally. It kind of does.
Media, I can make the case. Sports, a little bit. You know, Israel has to play in the European leagues, right?
Yeah, and the Maccabi
games. Denying their continental.
Let's don't forget the Maccabi games.
That's like an intra-Israeli or a Jewish competition, right? But, you know, no Iranian will wrestle them, which is a shame since Iran's very good wrestlers. Though, from what I understand, Jews are, or at least Israelis are pretty good at, I think it's judo. Maybe that's a coincidence, judo.
You're already getting into cancellation territory, so I'm going to let you fly solo here, okay? But the funny thing is, to the extent that you and I get into trouble on Israel, we get into trouble from opposite sides. And that's what's fascinating. And it's related to media too, you know, because a person could get canceled if a person weren't careful, or a person could lose part of one's audience if a person weren't careful.
Right.
And we're not careful. So I guess we've lost audience.
Well, I think we try to be careful. We're just not always strategic before we hew to what we define maybe grandly as our godfatherly ethos. The things we do are the things we do. And even if the subjects are difficult, we do them. And then, you know, you find a lot of your audience rejecting you or fleeing, as is their right. But if they're exercising their right for the wrong reason, it's a little annoying.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll start out with, I wanted to say more about you. So yeah, you were at Slate. You know, Slate has an underappreciated role in podcasts itself. I mean, how long is Gabfest? Remember, so I was involved in the founding of Slate. In fact, I just saw Mike Kinsley last weekend for the first time in a decade. Mike was the founder of Slate. I was in DC and I saw him. And I was involved. I had a column at the very origin of Slate called The Earthling, which, by the way, is the name of the Friday newsletter, the Non-Zero newsletter. It persists. But anyway, I remember going to these retreats early on, late 90s, where we would talk about Slate. And they were already getting some kind of podcasty thing off the ground. I think it was called Gabfest, right? Wasn't it?
Yeah. So this was, you were doing retreats at the Microsoft campus in Redmond?
Well, no, it was more exotic than that. It was in Washington State, but I'm happy to say we would drive from there to some exotic locale and, you know.
Yeah. Just like MSNBC, they own some of their parentage to Microsoft. Right. And Kinsley was, you just sparked something. Kinsley was in the news last week with those Susie Wilde revelations were correctly labeled Kinsley gaffes which are, of course, when someone says something that is totally true and the only gaffe is that they actually said it.
Right, right. He said in Washington, a gaffe is when you say something that's true. That's actually not totally irrelevant to what we'll be talking about in the overtime segment, possibly. But
So Slate was a really important magazine for what they were doing and taking the world of print into the world of screen. And they even, do you remember this in the beginning? And this is before I was there. I was at National Public Radio for 10 years. So they lured me over to Slate to do the third iteration of a Gab Fest that they had started, the Sports Gab Fest, which they called Hang Up and Listen.
Right.
But the very first one was the Political Gab Fest, which still exists with the same three hosts. And this is a testament to chemistry and talent, David Plotz and Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, who has just left CBS to do what? I'm not exactly sure, but to be the most eloquent man in media on that platform. And they've been doing that for 20 years. And not only did they, it was a proof of concept, it showed that the, I think, platonic ideal for a discussion show is three people, unless it's a one-on-one where the heads are blogging at each other, a permanent panel of three people always talking about sports with three different topics and maybe a bonus topic at the end. Do you know how often that format has been repeated? Because it works. I say platonic ideal, the three legs of a stool. And those three people are really important. Then they started a bunch of other podcasts. And a guy named Andy Bowers mm-hmm. was brought over from NPR to run the thing. And they ran it very well for a while. And then they introduced a new show that Leon Neyfakh did called Slow Burn. And that was very successful.
Oh, yeah.
But since then, my analysis of podcasting is that in the beginning, I think podcasters, the first movers were smarty pants places like Slate, but also all the public radio NPR people. And in the beginning, people thought that there was something about podcasting that was a little unique to versus other media, and they told themselves a story that, the podcast audience is a special audience. They're a little more, they wouldn't say highbrow, but they want this bespoke, refined product, such as the interaction between podcaster and audience. And what I think that was is the most skilled people in the space were public radio people, and that's what they knew how to do. Mm-hmm. And they knew how to do it at a pretty high price point. So now, it turns out that not only do two people talking attract an audience just as much as a producer working exquisitely over a second of sound for hours at a time. And sometimes this literally does happen. A couple of seconds of sound are three or four people could work on it for days on end. So the people talking is not just a good business model, but it reflects human nature and where we are as a society. And so this pulled out the rug from a lot of the bespoke NPR high production value podcasts. It's really hard to get one of those done. So in a sentence, mm-hmm. podcasting went from a combination of things dominated by audio documentaries to a medium like everything else, where the documentary form is expensive and therefore done less frequently.
Yeah. And by the way, at some point we should talk about the role of the possible role of AI in the future of all these media. It'll influence some more than others. I don't think they're quite there on the replace humans for podcasting front. Have you used the Google Notebook thing, the fake podcast thing? I mean, it's very useful for a certain purpose, but it's not yet. Gonna replace
it. No, I used it once to do a segment on the show where I picked sections of actual public radio shows and played it next to the Google thing and showed you just how little value add actual human beings were, because there was something about a lot of, I guess, mediocrely done NPR programs. This is how they build the model. They ape that. They can do that. And so if you're not doing something special, the AIs can give you the exact replacement level hosting, not just with podcasts, but with everything, right? If you're not writing an article any better than Wikipedia plus an interview with a principal, you're going to get beaten by AI.
Yeah. Yeah. The what I've used it for is, and if people don't know, it's like you can just feed it a PDF, like say of a book or something, and then it will generate an actual podcast without any humans involved in the generation that sounds like two real humans talking. It's not that bad. I mean, I'm kind of growing tired of these two particular humans. And by the way, this did train on two actual humans. So it's always the same man and woman. But what it's good for me is if, like, I need to talk about something, possibly even on a podcast, and I'm running behind, I didn't get much of the book read, I'm not as conversant in the think tank report as I should be or whatever. So I feed it to them, and like while I'm doing my daily exercise, I listen to what they say. It's better than nothing. I mean, it's just completely shocking that it can happen. It would have shocked me years ago.
Is it better than reading the report because the report is totally written for not a mass audience? And this, even though to me it's so annoying and the tropes of fake laughter, and I'm not sure if Google Notebook does this. I know that the Washington Post has a version of this where there are two fake AI hosts doing their version of the daily, and they have a lot of us in their speech because that is how humans speak. Does the Notebook one do that?
I don't remember whether they do many us, but they do a lot of authentic, you know, accents like that. Like it sounds like people. And you ask, is it better than reading? Well, if you're on your 1 hour bike ride and it's not a stationary bike, but a real bicycle in the real world, it's much better than reading.
No, I meant, is it better than having it read to you, books on tape version? Like a lot of places will translate it into just the audio.
Oh, I see. If you were just reading the transcript of their conversation, that would be faster.
Or if you press,
I mean, I have attention problems. I'm not a very efficient reader, but for the average human, that would be faster. Yeah.
No, I think you're probably better than the average human. The other thing that it does is it's conversational in a way that just annoys the hell out of me, where the male host will say, you know, what's really so interesting, and then it's 50-50 if the thing they point to is interesting, and then the female host will say, I noticed that. I don't need that. But listen to me nitpicking the delivery of computers as exactly I would the delivery of public radio hosts.
Yeah,
that's so interesting. We could do the version of that. Yeah, Bob. That really is interesting.
Well, there are a lot of podcasts where that's built into. You know, we won't get into the New York Times Daily. We won't get into a critique of the New York Times Daily. But I would just say,
listen to two people saying, "Yeah, you know, you're right." And another, there's so much agreement. Can you program the two to just have a slap down fight? Maybe in the after segment, maybe just like one brings up Israel and the other loses her shit.
That's what we need: is a podcast that just falls apart in the middle of it. They never speak to each other again.
If it really trained on the humans, the podcast staff would refuse to work if it didn't like the work, if it didn't like the conclusions of the podcast.
I'm not going to. I guess we'll get into that later. The question of whether that's happened to you. But now where we are. So there are these. Let's go back to the days of blogging, first of all. That was a, you know, print blogs, you know, what, 20 years ago, a little more. Because when the Iraq war was starting to happen, blogs were big. There were the so-called war bloggers who supported the war. That was an era of decentralization, we thought, in kind of media power. Suddenly anybody could become, you know, influential, it seemed. Then there was kind of a reconsolidation, I think. I mean, first of all, certain blogs started getting big audiences and becoming dominant, like Instapundit became dominant. But now Instapundit, I guess it still exists. I don't know, but it's certainly not what it was. And I think what you've seen in the blog space, you saw kind of further consolidation of power, but then Substack came along, and maybe that was another decentralization. But the latest wave of Substack is all of these exiles from MSM starting their Substacks. And for me, that's a problem. I mean, attention, you know, I've got a Substack. It's got 50,000 subscribers, but it's taken me a long time to get that. And, you know, now the problem you face is time is finite for all of us. If you're a podcaster, if you've got a Substack, there's only so much time, you know, people can give you. And so as big names move in, as the sheer number of newsletters grows and the sheer number of podcasts grows, and you get the competition from all corners, really good kind of impromptu seeming podcasts, really good, highly produced podcasts. You know, there's just more and more competition for eyeballs. The total amount of attention in the world does not increase. And so maybe we're in another wave of consolidation. I don't know. I think I've just kind of, I think that was an incoherent little stream of thought. So I'll just let you jump in wherever you want.
No, but some of this stuff I'm not expert in, and then I joined this space and became expert in. So everything you're saying comports with my analysis too. The blogging, the early wave of blogging, and I was talking to Matt Lewis about this, who does his own stuff now, but he was talking about, this is mostly the conservative space, that they were telling themselves, oh, the gatekeepers have been, if not stabbed through the heart, set aside, the gates open, and now 100 voices will bloom. But they were experts of one ilk or another within the conservative sphere. So Jonah Goldberg, who would have and was having a fine career, really blew up with his blog. And Michelle Malkin, who is certainly on the extreme right end of things, did too. But so did Matt Lewis. And Matt Lewis was essentially, he was saying, the favorite blog of the John McCain type. And so McCain, the politicians themselves said all the action is in blogging. And Democratic politicians did this too, elevating, you know, Ezra Klein or Matt Iglesias as the bloggers of the moment. And there were more of the less of the policy guys and more of the who's up, who's down guys. But the barrier to entry was lower, but it was still someone with a lot of expertise who could maybe appeal to other experts, because there wasn't a way for just anyone to actually effectively get any blog. Even the New Republic and the National Review, they launched blogs off their platform. So the imprimatur of those brands still mattered. Now, how about you? When you were, I guess you had Earthling and Slate. Where were you getting your attention during the blogging days? How were you earning your attention?
Well, I never had a blog. I started blogging Heads TV with Mickey Kouse in 2005. And that was to the extent that I was getting attention. It was either writing pieces for mainstream media. I wrote, you know, New York Times op-eds, and I still wrote for Slate for a while and whatever. But a lot of the time was spent on blogging Heads, which for a while was a real thing. In fact, for a while, we ran on the homepage of the New York Times. We would create an edited excerpt, because blogging Heads was often like, you know, debate, like left, right. You know, David Korn, Jim Pinkerton was a common feature on the New York Times. But we would put, you know, any two people who are having a good debate, we would carve out 4 or 5 minutes, 6, 7 maybe, and it would go on the New York Times. And there wasn't like a micro editing. It was pretty much just that stretch of the conversation. Now, these days, that probably wouldn't be fast moving enough to warrant, you know, to get the attention or to warrant that commitment from the New York Times. But anyway, you know, and
I think these days, it might. I think it was just the topics would be a little more, either you could say carefree or careless, right? I think that there'd be a lot of attention between, well, we saw Piers Morgan and Nick Fuentes, because all the media is also becoming TV. So the aesthetic of Blogging Heads TV, you guys and your wired headphones, and we could, you know, and the background is maybe a nice set of books versus someone on a set and someone with a little production value, but saying the most outrageous things. That flies now.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, we were, and, you know, from the beginning, there was an audio download. I don't think it was originally distributed via RSS, so maybe in that sense it wasn't technically a podcast, but I could argue I was doing a podcast 20 years ago, and that it was a platform that often featured two people other than me. Yeah, so I never had a blog. I had a blog at The Atlantic for 1 year in 2010 or 11. I'm not a good blogger. I'm not the blogging type. I survived.
You're not made of blogging stuff. If you had to do it again, let's say you saw where things were going, how would you have changed Blogging Heads TV to be a million-dollar property bought up by Skydance or whoever these days?
Very painful.
Are there any
very
changes?
Painful question, Mike. In other words, Bob, how did you fuck up your first mover advantage? Is that what you're asking, Mike? Go ahead, say it. Okay, no, I can take it. I'm fine.
But the DNA.
No, hit me hard. Hit me hard. Take your best shot.
Me too. Punch me. I've been doing a daily podcast for years, and I'm still doing it out of my own home.
I will say, I this is a psychological coping mechanism, 100%. But the most obvious things you would have done are things I wouldn't want to do. Like, in other words, the best way to maximize that kind of thing is to just not give a shit about the ideology you're serving or the message. And look, I will emphasize, it's like at the beginning, I wasn't serving an ideology except when I was on it. And look, I was building up an audience for the platform that I then exploited when I was on it. So yeah, I was serving my ideology, but also, you know, it was fair, honest. It was like debate, something that seems more precious now in a way than it did then because we're more polarized. But I would have honest, you know, these two people engaging. And by the way, there was an interesting dynamic. I would get two people on who had said nasty things about each other on blogs, and then they would meet face to face, often for the first time. And I say face to face, they couldn't see each other because this was kind of pre-broadband. You know, what they were doing was taping a video locally, talking on the phone, and then it wound up looking like this looks. But in any event, they were talking to each other, and that had an interesting civilizing effect, sometimes to a disappointing extent. They'd say like, well, let's just agree to disagree. And I'd be like, no, disagree, you know? Where was I? I was trying to avoid your question. That's where I was trying to get as far away from possible from the question of why I'm not rich and famous. You would have, what would you have done you just hired some Silicon Valley person to do the smart shit. I don't know. I mean, well, you'd need just somebody who is a better manager, administrator. I'm too detail oriented. I'm just bad at this kind of shit.
Too detail oriented. Wow, that's my opposite problem.
Well, maybe that's not the way to put it. But look. You would never guess to look at the production values of my podcast that I'm in some sense a perfectionist. But I guess I'm more of a micromanager than is optimal. Enough about me. What would you?
What you just said about bringing two people together, I've noticed it for a long time. And Ezra Klein and Andrew Sullivan had been going at it for a while, very nastily. And then they got together on Ezra's podcast, and it was so amiable, it was almost shocking. And I began to think about just the dynamics of being nasty in print, or I guess in a silo, versus being nasty even with people over electronic airwaves. I wrote about this in the Washington Post, and I thought it was mostly a good thing, and I still think it is, but I just don't think it's scalable. So I read a lot of literature about polarization and where we are and the extremes of the Nick Fuentes of the world. And I don't think this probably does apply with someone like Candace or Nick Fuentes, but you could take most regular people with a big to medium sized platform who want to operate as generally liked people in the world and don't have FU money or an FU audience. Mm-hmm. And they'll get along, right? They'll get along because that's who we are as a species. But what does that really mean or say other than a little blip of false promise? I mean, I've been to many of these things and then the congratulations of the people who can agree to disagree. I keep coming back to words like false promise or, you know, it's a signal of a hope that actually is only achievable in the weird format of a podcast as opposed to how we're actually going to interact in real life, which is online, which is so often online. You can't discount that.
Yeah. Yeah. The one related frustration I face in the current media environment is just that obviously the way to maximize your audience, and right now, social media is transforming into non-social media, basically, because a new kind of algorithm, the TikTok algorithm, is starting to govern Twitter and so on. So the dynamics are changing. But what I'm about to say was certainly true a couple of years ago. And I actually think it's still true. I'm just not quite sure. Which is that the best way to get to build up an audience is to mobilize your tribe, to talk shit about the other tribe, to single out people in the other tribe. And the most efficient way is to dishonestly depict what they said, to take cheap shots.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are people who have made an art of this. And I'll name a name who's on my side ideologically. Well, not entirely, but left of center, like me. And it's this guy, Aaron Rupar. I haven't checked in on him lately. I don't know if you know the guy, but he does... He does these tweets. He used to do these tweets last time I looked at him, and he built up a huge audience. He was where I think he was Advice for a while, but anyway, he's gone solo. And they were always quote tweets depicting somebody like in the Trump tribe or the conservative tribe. And it wasn't quite inaccurate what he said, but he was kind of taking them out of context, getting the maximum, you know, and like we could all do that. It's just like, it's not productive. I don't find it fun. It's the opposite of what the world needs. And those are the people on both sides who have no trouble finding an audience.
Yes, I got into it with Aaron Rupar while the Trump administration, first version of the Trump administration, was waning. And my theory was totally wrong, which is that in this crazed moment, what Aaron Rupar delivers, which are mostly out of context tweets of horrible things that the Trump administration of MAGA says, there's going to be a declining audience for that. And there wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, it's a definitely less extreme version of libs of TikTok. It's look at these idiots Twitter, right? And sometimes there, I don't know if there are many that if you saw the whole thing, you would just smack your forehead and say, no, that's not what they were saying. But they're all in, and I hate this cliche phrase, they're all in a certain bad faith, right? They're not trying to explain what actually happened to a fair minded person.
Go ahead.
Yeah, they're not. It's like, if there was the ideal fair-minded observer, would you ever present it in this way? No, you wouldn't. But there isn't the ideal observer, and he understands the audience. And his only trick early on, he had this editing software that could clip small pieces of video that you would say, doesn't everyone have that? Now they do. But in 2017, they didn't. And he got a first mover advantage. And he's huge. He's huge. And the audience, not to complain about Aaron Rupar, of all the people doing good or bad things, he's slightly on the eye-rollingly bad side of it, or I wish it were better. But you know what? If he was Mr. Context, Johnny Context, he'd be no one. He wouldn't have a job, you know? Right. His side, I always wondered how he made money on Twitter before monetization was really easy. And he had I'll say this a little dismissively, side hustle of doing trainings about how to be relevant media. I have no idea if any of them worked. But yeah, it's just... There are so many people who are of that ilk who embody exactly what you say. I was just listening to Dan Abrams, who I think is pretty good and has done some good things and bad things. But he says, if you want to make money in the world, be a conspiracy theorist. If you want to lose money, be a debunker. He even had a debunking site called Gossip Cop, and it didn't do well. Because as he says, people love gossip. They don't love cops.
Yeah. Maybe if you were a conspiracy theory debunker who focused on one side only, I think you might have a shot. But anyway, yeah, it's a problem. I mean, it's especially a problem for me because I have perhaps ill-advisedly made it almost part of my brand that I don't do that. And, you know, that makes it more awkward when you do it. It's harder to subscribe to the business model that your own business model purports to be opposed to. But yeah, I don't want to whine too much, but I'm trying to...
Although there are plenty of Christian preachers who, you know, had extramarital affairs and it helped their business, I think.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll just have an extramarital. Oh no, that's a different realm of aspiration entirely.
I've offended you, my God.
No, it's true. But they had those privately and secretly and hoped they wouldn't be uncovered. It's hard to become a tribalist in a way that helps build your audience and do it secretly, I think. But anyway.
Yes, and it's hard to do it with any generosity towards the other side. It's hard to do it. You know, sometimes what I do on the show is I say, yeah, you're right. Directionally, you're right with, say, let's take something. Dan Bongino said, when I was an opinion guy with my own show, yeah. I came to certain conclusions about who bombed the DNC and the RNC. Now that I'm with the FBI, I'm in a different line of work. And everyone took this to mean, I used to be able to lie my ass off, now I can't. But that wasn't what he was saying. No one wants me to hear the full giving Dan Bongino every benefit of the doubt context. So I don't, except here, once in a half a sentence.
Yeah. So I don't know. Do we just sound like guys who are whining? Well, you tell me what is working for you changed? I mean, you have a big audience. I mean, we'll talk in overtime about ways to talk about Israel that might reduce one's audience. But you still have a big audience. Have you found yourself adapting what you do to the changing landscape?
Not so much in terms of my format has stayed the same, and I'm open to experimenting and tweaking it. But some of the stuff is it works, or it works well enough as a delivery mechanism for what I want to do. I do have a couple of sort of shows within the show. I interview a comedian once every other week with the Comedy Cellar, and it's called Funny You Should Mention. Mm-hmm. And the point of that show is to get into, one of the slogans is, unpacking the profundities between punchlines. Just I was noticing all these comedians were being held out as truth tellers. This has gone on for a while, but maybe it's increased a little bit that it is the comedian who could see. It is the comedian who is holding up the lamp to society. So if they're going to be essentially funny op-ed writers, I'll question them as if they were public intellectuals. Sometimes I do it that way, and sometimes when the conversation doesn't lend itself to it, we'll talk about other things. So that's one show. And another one is Not Even Mad, which is something like you do, except I insert myself in the middle and try to bring a left person and a right person. That show is almost always good, but sometimes it breaks format because it's like you say, people get together, and even if they're inclined, ideologically inclined to disagree, they're usually temperamentally inclined mm-hmm. to agree and get along because we're humans of a species. So what I'll do is, instead of totally changing the format of the gist, incorporate different kind of little ways of doing versions of the show one day a week. And then the other one is sort of alternating every other week with Not Even Mad and Funny You Should Mention. I don't want to sound like two guys whining or complaining. There's a lot of interesting stuff being done in podcasting. What I always like to do is have those interesting people on and talk about it and point my audience to it. And one guy is, do you know this guy, Isaac Saul of Tangle?
I don't.
So Tangle, and it got a meteoric bump when This American Life did a segment mm-hmm. on it. The premise is where a polarized nation, and it's great to have some shared truth. So what Isaac does, who's a journalist and now has a staff of, I think, maybe in the very low double digits, as in 10, he will take news items, big items in the news, not news articles, but whole news items, and he'll give you what the left is saying, two or three people on the left analyzing it, what the right is saying, and then comes Isaac's take, or one of the three or four editorial people on his staff. And it's great. It's a little more work than just flipping through the news, but I think you understand what really is going on with the latest Epstein disclosures mm-hmm. better in that way than with anyone else. And he's doing really well. Now, the question is, scalable? Can it replace media? Is this the new version of media? I don't think so. I think it's a very workable niche. I even think that what Barry Weiss is doing, if you take what she's trying to do, or what she says she's trying to do at CBS, which is to present a news network that's between the 40 yard lines consciously. I don't know if that becomes the number one network, but right now it's the number three or five, depending on if you count the cable networks. So there's something to be said for a future where the kind of news and presentation that we like has purchased. I don't think it dominates. I don't think it's the new CNN. I think that all the trends you're talking about are so overwhelming that people want to talk to their tribe and think that the other tribe are satanic all the way down. But I think there's a possibility for success there.
Yeah. I probably have a less generous view of Barry Weiss than you do, but maybe that'll come up in overtime. It's funny, I just had an exchange with...
I think you talked to... I heard you talking to Paul Bloom about him, maybe.
Yeah. I just had an exchange with Noam Dorman, the owner of the Comedy Cellar, which you mentioned, about Barry Weiss. I mean, like, half an hour ago on Twitter. No, must have been 45 minutes on Twitter. But yeah, who's the comedian, by the way, speaking of that, that you have on once a week?
No. I do it with a different comedian.
It's somebody who's done the Comedy Cellar there, which Noam is a proprietor of. Yeah.
Correct. Uh-huh. I had dinner with Noam two days ago. And so we were.
Yeah,
it's easy to have dinner with Noam when you go into Comedy Cellar because he'll buy you a dinner and the food's great.
I haven't done that version. I had coffee with him at the above the floor. I guess.
Yes, the olive
maybe
tree.
Maybe I didn't merit the cellar treatment, the full cellar treatment. I know.
No, that's what it is. It's there. It's the place above the Comedy Cellar. It's the olive tree. Yeah. It's
great. I did use the bath. Yeah, I did get to go downstairs to use the bathroom. I've seen the Comedy Cellar.
He lets you into the bathroom. Yeah, one day.
Urgent.
Yeah, one day I'll give you full access.
If you have a compelling rationale, you can see, even I can see.
That's not just you. If you go to this delicious restaurant, you ask to use the bathroom, it's this asterisk.
Okay, you have
to go through America's. Yeah,
now, what's it
great.
Called?
You
the
have
olive,
to go through America's
called,
premier
tree?
Comedy
What
club.
Is it called?
Tree.
Yeah. People should go. It's in the Village of New York. You live in New York?
I live in Brooklyn,
yeah. Okay. Brooklyn's part of New York. More than ever. The question increasingly is Manhattan part of New York? But,
there's one Mom Donnie to unite us, from what I understand. This is how it's going to work.
I got a feeling you're not totally on team Mom Donnie.
I'm open. If you told me that, you know, all the young people were coming out to vote and people are excited about politics and you ticked off five of his seven big proposals, like, let's try a free bus. I don't think it'll change things, but let's try it.
I was wondering, will homeless people not now sleep on the buses more? Am I thinking too far ahead here? But if it's
you're thinking 1.5 steps ahead, which is more than the planners have. So yeah, this is a problem. This is what happened in Austin. I like when they do stories about Des Moines, how it worked in Des Moines. I'm like, yeah, that's really applicable to New York City.
Map comparison. Des Moines. How many times have
Those
I said
bus lines, you know, in New York.
York reminds me of Des Moines? Yeah.
I was watching Spinal Tap with my kids last night, and I so far overhyped it because it's my favorite movie. Okay. And my kids are 19 and 17, and the 17-year-old just rebelled against me insisting this is the funniest thing he's going to see. But the 19-year-old loved it. And there is a line in there where David St. Hubbins is saying, I don't know, we got canceled out of a place called Des Moines. It's in India or something.
Well, you know, part of the generational issue with that, I think, is it's part, you know, it's to a large extent a spoof of a genre, a documentary genre that doesn't really exist. That isn't what documentaries are exactly like anymore. They're somewhat like that. You should get the joke, but.
Yes. So this is exactly my critique. Well, maybe a degree off, which is that part of the joy of it, and it hangs together as a very good three-act movie with rising drama and all of that. But part of the joy was it basically invented the mockumentary. Yep. There was the Ruddles beforehand. There was a Danish one about a serial killer. But it was so new and you had to kind of orient yourself. And now we've been so oversaturated with that form. It's the default form of so many NBC shows. They just do things because, you know, The Office was successful and other lesser shows, but Modern Family was successful to the point where I think you have to make a choice not to do a sitcom as a mockumentary these days. Uh-huh. And it's not only not special, it's oversaturated in whatever jokes there are, or whatever joy there is in kind of figuring out the genre. It doesn't exist anymore. It's like listening to Sgt. Pepper's because all the great engineering feats have been so incorporated into every other bit of music. It doesn't seem revolutionary.
Okay, so we had said we would talk about sports, the future of sports. I could do hours with you on that. But we don't have hours before we head into our overtime segment. But let's do talk a little about the future of sports. I mean, first, I could do the standard old guy complaints. Why don't they call traveling anymore? I guess I won't do that. But so I think the big issues are like, is sports becoming something so different from what it is that it's in danger of self-destruction? I'm thinking of gambling. I'm thinking of name, image, likeness. We'll get into that. But quickly on the traveling question, I assume there's been no actual change in the rule book, because I'm sure if you looked at the rule book that existed 30 years ago, they're obviously traveling and not. You can't take three steps. I'm sorry. You know, according to what it used to say in the rule book. And I have the same question about pass interference in football. That has changed. But have they changed the rules, or just they just no longer pay attention to them?
They've reinterpreted the rules. So this gather step or the Euro step, is what makes it look like a third step. But if you break down forensically, Zapruder-like film, you could technically see the case that they're only making two steps, and this is what they were doing all in Europe, and Manu Ginobili came over to the NBA and started doing it. And do we just illegalize all of Manu Ginobili's game? It's a pretty good game. And there's the case that it really is two steps, how often your feet hit the floor without dribbling. And then there is the gather, which is a part of dribbling. So break this down to people who don't watch it. Yeah,
I'm going to stick with the old guy complaining stick. I'm sure I had assumed that what the rule book says is once they have two hands on the ball, the counting starts and you get... I played in high school, it was like one step. That's it. You can put your foot down one time, I think I'm counting right. In any event, they now give them one more step than they used to give them. And what is this gathering shit? You put two hands on the ball and the fucking dribbling is over, okay? And then you get a finite number of steps. And if you're going to change the rules, rewrite the fucking book. I'm sorry. I should calm down.
things were less bouncy in your day. Now it's you get the ball, step, step, and then there's a jump.
So yeah, I understand step, step, that. Jump, but it's just, I'm sure it's not what the rule book says.
I have to go with reinterpretation.
There's an analogy with pass interference. Like it used to be like if the defensive player touches the guy before the ball gets to the receiver, the like split end or whatever, like that was pretty much pass interference.
The split end, the flanker, Lance Allworth and those of his ilk.
Now let's don't get into Lance. I was thinking Lance Rensel. That's what I didn't want to get into. But never mind, folks. This is a family show. So just quick little analogy here. Pass interference is an inherently hard thing to call. That it's not like traveling. Right. Traveling, you can lay down the law and decide whether they're violating it. And folks, they are. Pass interference is inherently trickier. More contact is allowed at that end, and more contact is allowed in basketball than was allowed like 40 years ago. When I was in high school, the way they handled the challenge of figuring out, you know, was this too much? Was this too little? Was they had a foul that I think was actually called even reaching in. Does this ring a bell? Mm-hmm. It was like, if you were guarding a guy and you just reached your arm around the body, they would say reaching in. It didn't matter whether you actually touched him. It was just like, we need a bright line. Okay. We're going to be strict. It's a bright line. Anyway, enough about that. You can say anything about pass interference you do or don't want to say. We'll move on to gambling.
I don't think those things have hurt the game at all. I think that mostly what has hurt the game, before we get to the gambling, is the introduction of technology. And maybe there's a societal analogy. The pursuit of justice without acknowledging how hard it's going to be and who defines what is justice. So I don't know, maybe it's a little like body cams. But now that we have all these ways to so finely look at how the ball interacts with the ground and everyone at home can see it, football, basketball to some degree, baseball in certain ways has become an exercise in forensic videography.
Yeah.
And ever since we're all watching the game at home, this is really what our sport is. So we might not be, we're definitely not better than any of these athletes, but we could debate whether the ball was controlled while scraping the ground. Or my absolute least favorite, which is in basketball, sometimes the defender will slap the ball out of the ball possessor's hand. But this is just how physics sometimes work. If you could slow it down and look at the grains of every frame, the ball actually is in contact with the possessor's hand last, after the slap. But it was entirely the slap that got it out of the guy's hand. And if we didn't have the tool, we would say, oh, the defender slapped the ball away. The last guy to touch it was the defender. But now that we have the ability not to say this, we trick ourselves and we work ourselves into a lather trying to get it, quote unquote, right. And by getting it right, we lose sight of the fact that these things are meant for entertainment. We could get into that with NIL. I hope we do. These are entertainment properties. When we slow them down for 3 minutes and especially apply that 3 minutes only in the last 2 minutes of a 40-minute game in NCAA basketball, there's no logic to that. A jump shot made 4 minutes in is worth just as much as a jump shot made with 2 minutes left. But it is unbelievably annoying. And it's interesting how there's so little way to unravel that. And I guess the leagues, the NBA are more attuned to that. The NCAA has fewer stakeholders to nudge them off their position. But I get most annoyed with the announcers. There is a strain of announcer, the Van Gundy brothers are like this, who will just bitch and moan about all the amount of time taken to look at the replay. But that's what everyone watching the game is thinking. The NCAA college announcers will always say the thing, well, the only important thing is you get it right. No, you're down 10. This won't affect the game. And we saw who slapped the ball out of the fella's hand.
Well, plus, life is hard. Justice doesn't always happen. I wrote a piece for the New York Times when I had an online column, a while ago. This must have been at least 10 years ago. It was when they were starting to do the review in baseball. And I was like, please, no. Like, you know, it's going to slow things down. And you know, it's an important lesson that, you know, shit happens. You get bad breaks.
Right.
You get bad calls. You roll with the punches. Life is not fair. We do our best. We, you know, and I obviously did not prevail. I'm wondering, I mean, I understand the pickle they're in to have these obviously bad calls determine like a World Series or something and not intervene is challenging. I'm wondering
the reason that they're so obviously bad is the technology allows us to see that. Now, sometimes Don Denkmeyer with the Cardinals, yes, sometimes we could all see that even with our old grainy non-HD TV video.
Yeah.
But, you know, especially when, remember the era in baseball, and they did not pursue this anymore, that a tag was made, but the tag, the part of the glove that came into contact with the base runner was the strings of the glove. It is now strings don't count rules, because once you start calling guys out,
you got 5 foot strings on gloves, right? Yeah, I see where this could head. Right.
You're in emanations of penumbra territory, baseball version.
Yeah, yeah. No, that makes sense. Name, image, likeness. If there's anybody who doesn't know, this happened, I guess, a few years ago. They decided that college athletes, I mean, the amateur ethos has been in decline for decades, you could say, because when I was a boy, Olympic athletes were not allowed to have had any professional involvement in sport. You didn't have NBA players on basketball teams in the Olympics. And people said, wait a second, the Soviet Union, like, for these guys, it's a career being an Olympic athlete. They get paid. And that was one thing that led to the change of rules. But in any event, the latest iteration of the demise of the amateur ideal is college athletes can now, people can pay them to use their name, image, or likeness in ads for commercial purposes. Now, when this happened, I predicted accurately, I think, that this was kind of the NIL would often be a cover story for what used to be illegal, which is just the local booster who has a lot of money and wants the college team to succeed, pays good athletes to come to the college. It used to happen under the table. When they caught them, it was a scandal. And now they can just say, you know, I'd love to put out an ad with you. Here's $1 million and I'll put it on my website once or whatever ritual they go through. So that's happened. And, you know, these guys, my take is they do deserve money. It's just not fair that all of these guys, many from very low income backgrounds, would help this college make a shitload of money in some cases. And they may dream that someday they will be in the NBA or the NFL. Usually that doesn't work out. Usually they just go there, don't even get a good education because half the time, you know, the coach helps them not get one by making sure their classes are bullshit. And then, I think they deserve money. But one among the consequences that are iffy is it's led to this transfer epidemic where like a guy goes to college 1 year, gets recruited to go to another, you know, they keep switching. So the very, and maybe it's okay that the fiction that these guys are true students is entirely burst. I don't know, but that is a consequence, right?
Yeah. So just to go back to the Soviets getting paid in basketball and hockey, that's another example of we righted the injustice. It was unjust that the Americans couldn't have an equivalent. So I guess justice righted, except product worse or experience worse. Yeah. Just ask anyone who tries to play against the dream team. But the NIL system was executed really poorly. It was barely executed. I think it was one of those things that the poobahs of NCAA basketball and football were so ashamed and didn't want to do it, wanted to do it at arm's length, that they just had no follow through and they didn't think it through. And so now it's the Wild West and we don't even know how much people are paid. And then sometimes the athletes don't know how much they're paid. The information being powerful, it all is in the hands of certain boosters and certain agents. So there are situations where, unlike the NFL, where if an offer is made, a rumor of an offer can be made to a kid. And then he says, I'm coming to University of Las Vegas, Reno. And then, oh, it wasn't a $600,000 offer and it was $400,000. You told me $600,000. Now I'm screwed out of my old team. There are guys who have played for seven teams in what's supposed to be a four-year college career with injury redshirting, with COVID, that gave guys another year of eligibility, but seven teams, they bounce back and forth, and it has made the game worse. When I started on that show, Hang Up and Listen, that I mentioned, the two big issues that we would always rail against was the lack of adaption of advanced statistics into all sports and the fact that college athletes were getting exploited. And both of those have changed. In fact, our original complaints, none of them exist. And they've both changed the sports for the worst. I like advanced statistics. I like being clever. But baseball itself had to outlaw some of the consequences of advanced statistics, like the shift. And when it comes to NIL, it is unfair that Tim Tebow was selling, without the name Tebow on the back, but with his uniform number, selling more jerseys than any NFL player. That's how popular he was. And couldn't see a cent of that. So from that injustice, we go to no one is on a team for more than 2 years. Teams are just bought. I'm a big fan of St. John's. They have one returning player. He is good. They have six guys who they paid a lot of money to. The guy who invented vitamin water has given the St. John's Red Store millions of dollars. They threw millions of dollars at these guys. And they're the most incoherent mess of a team you've ever seen. And by the way, their best player last year, who was the Big East player of the year, RJ Lewis, went pro, which is what you should do if you want to make money. But he got hurt and now he's playing for maybe $50,000 on a minor league contract. Mm-hmm. If that poor guy had just stayed in school, that is $1 million job, $1.5 million job to be the returning Big East player of the year. It's so sad. And it made the entertainment product worse, is my point. There's no continuity with the teams. It gave you a little bit of justice, or it corrected an injustice that we could all see. And the people benefiting from the old system were the schools and the coaches. Now the schools and the coaches still benefit. Certain particular athletes benefit, but the overall experience in the game itself is much worse. Conferences no longer exist. Yeah. And there seems to be no plan or structure, sort of like the rollout of legalized marijuana in New York State, to actually be organized. That's the important thing. Just have a structure, have rules, have knowable payment systems. You know, the absence of an injustice isn't justice, I say.
Yeah, I do worry that it's, as your experience with St. John's kind of attests, it's going to make it harder to be a loyal fan. Wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if college sports fell apart. I mean, American college sports is almost a uniquely, you know, a unique thing to begin with. Countries survive without our version of sports. But I do think it's a threat if the team doesn't have that kind of inter-year coherence. And I would also say there's something nice about the building of the bonds among the teammates. So there's something different about winning a championship with a bunch of guys you've been with for a few years. And that's valuable. In terms of what you could do about it, here's an interesting little anecdote. So I went to high school in Texas, and this was already an issue in Texas, because Texas football is taken so seriously that it was already a thing that you would, especially like these oil towns, like Odessa Permian. I mean, that was the subject of Friday Night Lights, I think. And my family's from the Midland Odessa area, but like that's oil country. And especially these little oil towns No, what they would do is they would say to the father of a great athlete who lived far away, we'll get you a great job at our place. That was the form of the bribe. So what they had done was, it was if a first-year transfer student at a high school could not play varsity. And the funny thing is, I was going to a high school on Fort Sam Houston in Texas because my father was a lifer, career military officer. Everybody was a transfer student. I mean, you know, at that high school, it was just full of people who were there for the first year because that's the way the military is. It was I remember a great running back, a junior who couldn't play varsity. But anyway, that's one fix in principle, is just to say, no, if you transfer, you have lost a year of eligibility, right? Wouldn't be the worst thing, but have you thought?
Used to be the case. And the society, technology has actually solved the problem that they were trying to solve. And it's in the name, image, and likeness. So it is a fiction, as you say, right? It's just a way for boosters to have a fig leaf, a pretext of paying a guy for their name, image, or likeness. And when I talked about the injustice, the go-to totemic injustice of Tim Tebow selling all these jerseys, look, high school athletes and college athletes are very popular on Instagram. They're very popular social media content. All you do is change the rule that says if you have social media and you have however many followers and someone wants to pay you to do advertising on your social media platform, that does not interfere with what you do for your extracurricular activity. Right. And yeah, knowing now that the argument used to be, well, it could be an end around. We've already legalized the end around. So all you have to do is say our new name, image, and likeness regime is not to enforce, not to have a ridiculous rule about whoever earning money on the side. And then it becomes a lot easier. You take it away from the schools. You get these boosters out of it. And you don't have to pay. You know, there was, speaking of gambling, there have been many gambling scandals, and a very little attended to one is our players, a number of players on very, very bad Division I teams. So there are more than 200 teams in Division I basketball, and players on, I think it was Sam Houston State. I'll find out the real team. Three teams have been suspended and kicked out of basketball because they very clearly threw games. And these guys, so if there are 13 scholarships and 200 plus teams, you know, we're talking about thousands of players. And if you're paying all of them, or if you're obligated to pay all of them, 40,000, 50,000, 60,000, and they're upset that they're not getting paid more money, you're going to have temptations like throwing games for sports gamblers.
Yeah, that leads us to gambling. I'll quickly say that I think the social media solution makes sense. Just let them monetize their feeds. But it does, you know, it could lead, it could erode intra-team unity in the sense that now you have an even bigger incentive than players inherently have to want to be the star. That can get in the way. On the other hand, a lot of them are trying to build up big social media feeds already, so wouldn't be the worst thing. It seems to me like better than the current system.
Yes, the teams, by the way, the teams with suspended players are powerhouses: New Orleans, Mississippi Valley, and Arizona State, which is actually a decent enough team. But these are like 3 and 28 teams, and some of those 28 losses were by 40 and some were by 15. And you could tell when the games were being thrown.
Yeah. So quickly, before we head into overtime, and try to get ourselves into trouble, but at least in front of a smaller audience. What's your take on gambling? I mean, to set the scene, gambling, of course, has... it used to be just verboten. You couldn't get anywhere near professional sports, certainly. I mean, like Willie Mays, I think after he retired, he was going to be a spokesperson for a legal casino in New Jersey or something. And baseball demanded that he sever his contact with the sport entirely or something.
Yep. He was supposed to be a host.
Yeah.
An in-person host.
And and look, you can understand that the cause of the phobia. Obviously, players have been known to get paid to throw games or just to help give away points when there's a spread. But one thing that's happened now is this micro betting where there's people out there betting on, like, what's the next pitch the pitcher will throw. Well, you know, first of all, it's easy for the athlete to convince themselves, look, this isn't going to affect the outcome of the game. It's one fucking pitch. So we've had a scandal within the last year. I don't keep up, but I know that some player was, that was baseball, right?
There was a baseball, there was an NBA, there was an NBA mafia poker game scandal and an NBA game throwing scandal. They've had all of them. The NFL players have been suspended. I think hockey has avoided it largely.
Yeah. But so do you have A, concerns, and B, a solution if you have concerns?
Yes, I have tweaks. So the rollout was very bad. It was state by state. We won't even get into that. Some of the different states bargain different rates. So New York got a great percentage of the amount gambled, whereas states like Kansas, and the New York Times wrote about this well, pretty much over a steak dinner and a bunch of cigars, their legislators bargained away the cut that the state would get. So that's pretty horrible. The other thing, before we even get into sports gambling, the real scourge is online casinos, which are, you can play a slot machine on your phone, and this just ruins people. The percentage of state revenue from these online casinos, and very few states, seven states have them, this should just be legalized. This should never have been allowed to take place. It's ruining lives for a bit of tax dollars. As far as the gambling, this all changed when Adam Silver, first among the commissioners, the NBA commissioner, said that we need to embrace this rather than fight this. And the fight goes all the way back to the legitimacy of the game. And Kennesaw Mountain Landers, who came in as commissioner after the 1919 Chicago White Sox threw the World Series. And he was right. If people thought that the outcome of the game was illegitimate, people wouldn't watch the game. Absolutely true. And had to be enforced, and vigorously enforced, I think, for about 50 years. And then it became, I mean, Pete Rozelle, the commissioner of the NFL, definitely agreed with that. In the beginning, Roger Goodell did, because that was what he had always been taught. And there's something about the phrase integrity of the game that concentrates the mind and rallies the troops. But it was also true, and there were legitimate arguments that gambling can now be controlled. There is a benefit to having it be legalized. One is that just taking it out of the shadows, that old argument, it won't be controlled by the mafia. It could be controlled by, or give some money to the states. But also, if someone is throwing a game, these somewhat advanced algorithms can detect that. And that is true. All the guys that you're talking about were detected because of unusual activities that monitors, either human or computer, picked up. Mm-hmm. However, 19-year-olds, 21-year-olds don't have developed prefrontal cortices. And it is also true that having friction in the way of your vices is a way to limit one's own vices, but also society's impact of the people who have the vices. So if you have to travel to a state like Las Vegas to make a legal sports gamble, it's going to be much more rare that you gamble. Once you have it in your phone, and once you give it to 21-year-olds or 22-year-olds or any 19-year-old can access it, and it's very acute among boys, it becomes a real, real societal problem, even to the extent that I think a lot of the experts thought that was surprising. There is like consistent rates of addicted gambling, and it was in the 2s and 3s. And now we're seeing an addicted gambling rate at around 6. And the people it's ruining are young people. And so this is a atmosphere, this is a landscape that is far worse than even proponents of legalized gambling, of which I was one, had thought possible. As far as tweaks, you go with the low-hanging fruit first. You take these prop bets. Will the next pitch be a ball or strike? You take them off the table. You take the individual stat bets off the table. So this is, will an individual player have more or less than 12 points, 5 rebounds? And the reason is, these are really easy to throw, especially on the under. How do you do it? You do it like Jonte Porter, who is the NBA player who was kicked out of the league, did it. Just fake an injury in the first quarter. And then, of course, you hit the under. Mm-hmm. So you have to take all these bets under the table. I wouldn't allow any betting on a level of NCAA basketball or football below high Division I and maybe the tournament. I don't think people will throw games during the tournament. But, you know, the gambling companies have to give up a lot. And one secret is, it's not been a great business for the online gambling companies. They spend a lot of money in customer acquisition. They give a lot of their money to certain states, not Kansas, but New York. And if you look at the profits that they were promising and you look at their stocks, they've not been doing well. ESPN even got out of the gambling business. I mean, they're in the gambling business, but they now have a partner. They don't have ESPN bets. So that's another thing. If you want to talk about enjoyment of the game, just all these stats about the Packers are now -1.5 in the in-game spread, flashing that on the screen. It seems antithetical to why we got here in the first place.
Yeah, well, that was a pretty definitive take. We're going to...
It was long.
No, it was... You're very dynamic. You're clearly a veteran, successful podcaster. And again, before we head into overtime, the name of your podcast is The Gist. And you also have a newsletter, relatedly, called The Gist List. I was thinking, like, if you did like a monthly, for people who don't have time to read your newsletter like all the time, and you had like a monthly review, it could be called The Gist List Missed, like in case they missed The Gist List.
Yeah, or it could be just an ephemeral version of it, MIST, the Missed.
Oh, yes, The Gist List Missed. And then, then I could do like a critique newsletter called The Gist List Missed Dist. I could take
every 4 words and just play them, and that could be The Gist Missed List Dist Swiss, as in cheese, with all the holes in it.
I think the quality of rhymes is diminishing. anyway, so overtime, and this is really the content I personally would be willing to pay for. If I had any money, I mean, if podcasting were a more lucrative business, I mean, I'm not trying to tug on any heartstrings here, but you get access to overtime by being a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter. I encourage that. You'll also get the warm feeling you get when you subscribe to a newsletter that professes to uphold the values of anti-tribalism. And who doesn't want that feeling? Mike, who doesn't want that feeling?
This is what we, you know, this is what we pay for. We pay for 2 things. Some media apostate who leaves CNN or the Washington Post in a huff. I guess they get 100,000 followers automatically on Substack. But this, what we're talking about here, is what you should pay
for. Oh, man, I couldn't have said that better. Okay, so, but anyway, thanks everybody who's followed us this far. And over time, we're going to talk about the perils of expressing opinions about Israel, or maybe a particular category of opinions to one side or the other of the center. And I guess you and I have expressed opinions on different sides and both gotten into a certain amount of trouble. And we will talk about that. So hope you follow us into overtime. If you don't, thanks anyway. And we'll see you next time.